press and intimations of better things to come based on the way their squad competed against heavily favored Ridgefield Park and St. Benedict's of Newark, who outweighed the Saints by 15 pounds per man. The Lombardi-coached line impressed observers more than Palau's offense, which was based on the old Notre Dame box that he'd learned from Sleepy Jim Crowley. The two Fordham teammates developed a rivalry even as they worked together compatibly and slept in the same boarding house bed. They competed intensely in chess matches before school in the morning and during class breaks, huddled in the corner of the locker room. At night, after dinner, they gathered empty beer cans until they had enough to field two teams, then arrayed the cans on the table, which served as a playing field, and tried to outsmart each other with new formations. Before the third game against Tenafly, Palau asked Lombardi to give the team a pep talk, and when it was over, realized that his assistant had a fire inside that he could not match. "I knew he was intense about the game, and I knew he got excited," Palau said later. "But that pep talk was incredible. I'd never seen anything like it before. I was shaking in my boots when it was over, and I know the team was, too." Eyes bulging, eyelids blinking, fists clenched, Lombardi finished his speech, approached the starters one by one, said that they had done nothing to impress him during practice that week, and demanded more. "What are you going to do today?" he thundered. The Saints scored twice in the first period, then held firm the rest of the game for a 13-0 win. They did not lose again that season, which ended with the Saints establishing themselves as the new power in town with a 20-0 victory over crosstown rival Englewood Dwight Morrow on Thanksgiving Day. What worried Lombardi most was the daunting task of coaching basketball. He was absorbed by football strategy and thought he understood it. But basketball was alien to him even though he'd played on the Cathedral prep team. Palau, a three-sports star who'd captained the Fordham basketball squad, offered to help the first half of the season. He would teach Vince the zone defense, which was simple, he said. After football practice during the week, after games on weekends, they engaged in their basketball tutorials. Handy Andy could see that Vince had no feel for the game, but nonetheless was astute at picking up strategy and simplifying everything on court. After only 5 games, he decided to leave Lombardi on his own. "I could see he was doing as good a job as I could have done. He had a brain." In his first experience as head coach in any sport, Lombardi led the Saints to a winning season, though barely, at 10 wins and 9 losses. It took the players some time to adjust to him. Their previous coach had been an easy rider, in the words of Mickey Corcoran, the team's star player. And when Lombardi came in as a strict disciplinarian, the change was a bit of a culture shock. His emotions were never far from the surface. His eruptions became legendary. Of all the stories about his temper, the one that Saints basketball players most enjoyed telling in later years concerned the time he leaped from the bench in a rage, only to bang his head on a low-hanging steel girder in the Saints' cozy gym, a jolt that not only pained him, but quieted him for the rest of the game. Red Garrity, the coach at rival Englewood Dwight Morrow, thought that it occurred in a game between the two schools when a referee made a crucial call against Saints. Corcoran had a different memory, believing that he inspired the headbanging when, as captain on the court, he chose to shoot foul shots instead of taking the ball out of bounds, defying Lombardi's instructions. Corcoran, loose and cocky, with the natural basketball instincts his coach lacked, was Lombardi's pet, the first in a long line, and as such the most frequent witness to his mood swings. Before practice during the week, Lombardi enjoyed playing horse with Corcoran, Fred Schoenfelder, and Johnny Moon. "Match my shot. Make this one." The outcome was usually the same. The boys outshot him, but Lombardi remembered the one trick shot he threw in and boasted about it for days. After practice on Tuesdays, He occasionally invited the boys over to his room to play hearts. If he stuck one with the Queen of Spades, he went hilarious, his big teeth flashing an irrepressible grin. On more than one Friday afternoon, he found Corcoran after school and told him, "Call your mom, we're going out to Brooklyn for some home cooking." All the way out to the Lombardi house, they talked basketball, different defenses, college plays Vince had seen that week at Madison Square Garden. Lombardi was warming to the role of coach. It was what he imagined being a priest might be like, he told friends. He could be a father figure and leader. And unlike the priesthood, the coaching profession did not force him to repress his emotions. If he wanted to blow off steam, he could bark at the kids and no one would be shocked. He made a point of challenging Corcoran the most as a lesson to the others. After one loss, when Lombardi thought Corcoran had taken bad shots, he decided to punish him by making him take physical education for the rest of the semester, a course not required of varsity athletes. 2 weeks later, he realized that he had overreacted, apologized to Corcoran, and released him from gym class. That was the method of Coach Lombardi. Corcoran learned it from his mentor and used it himself when he became a high school coach years later, then passed it along to his own disciple, a North Jersey boy named Bill Parcells, who also became a coach. Rip your butt out, then pat you on the butt. Knock you down, then build you up, said Corcoran of Lombardi's style. He understood human behavior better than any person I've ever met. Late that first season, Lombardi and his blue and gold Saints were involved in a game that secured a place in the annals of the world's strangest basketball contests. It happened on the Thursday night of February 29th, 1940, when a powerful team from the North Jersey town of Bogota visited St. Cecilia for a leap day game that meant very different things to the two teams. For the Saints, whose mediocre record precluded any chance of making the postseason tournament, a victory would enhance their late run to respectability. The mission for Bogota, at least as coach Ev Habel perceived it, was merely to survive the game without wasting energy, preserving his boys for a tournament game later that week. His Bucks had established themselves as the superior team, having trounced the Saints earlier in the year. What followed the opening tip was an extraordinary clash of wills between Lombardi and Habel in an era before shot clocks or rules requiring a team to advance the ball up court. 30 seconds into the game, Johnny Moon fired up a long set shot for the Saints. The ball bounced off the rim, and the rebound was hauled in by Henry Baum of Bogota, who immediately revealed Habel's strategy, which was for his boys to do absolutely nothing. One arm akimbo, the other cradling the ball, Baum stood in one spot, motionless, stone-faced. Lombardi ordered his defenders to back off and wait for Bogota to go into its offense. For 7.5 minutes, Baum held the ball. Jeers and hisses hailed down from the stands. The second quarter was more of the same. The stall irritated Mickey Corcoran. He looked over at Lombardi and inched toward his man. Lombardi shook his head. "Stay back, stay back." He was furious at Habel, but determined not to give in. The shorter the game, he figured, the better chance the outmanned Saints had for pulling an upset. Saints won the tap to start the second half, and Corcoran, his fingers itchy from 16 minutes without a shot, quickly pumped one from outside. No good. Baum of Bogota had the ball again, assuming his familiar frozen posture. 19 minutes without a point. The crowd grew rowdier. Then Lombardi gave the signal, and the Saints moved up to press the ball. From then on, the game was normal basketball. The visitors had lost all energy to play even when they were instructed to do so. They took a total of 7 shots and never scored a basket. A lone free throw prevented them from being shut out. The final score was 6-1. After the game, an eerie quiet descended on the gym as Lombardi stalked across the court, He screamed at Hebel for his tactics, even though they'd backfired. It was cowardly, he said, for the better team to hold the ball and make a mockery of the game. Hebel remained calm. He said he was merely saving his team for the tournament and making a point against zone defenses, which he detested. The two men had to be separated, but parted without blows. They did not acknowledge each other for several years. At 9 o'clock one Sunday morning that spring, Palau was awakened by a pounding at the door. His roommate wasn't home. "Just a minute," Palau said, and got up and opened the door. There stood Marie Planets, dressed in Sunday clothes, tears streaming down her face. She and Vin had been fighting, she said, and the engagement was off. Where was he? She said that she was going across the street to attend Mass at Saints. Would Palau please help them get back together? When Lombardi returned late that afternoon, Palau told him about Marie's visit. As his roommate later described the scene, Lombardi seemed distraught, complaining that everywhere he turned, people were pressuring him to reconcile with Marie. Even his mother, who'd never expressed much appreciation for his girlfriend, now seemed to be urging him to make up. He was almost 27, she pointed out. He needed a wife, and Marie worshipped him. His younger brother, Harold, studying fine arts at Fordham, had also been drawn to Marie's side. While Vince was working at Saints, Harold and Marie occasionally took outings in the city. Harold shared his brother's temper and perfectionism, but had a more artistic nature. He and Marie enjoyed sitting in the courtyard at the Plaza Hotel, sipping Brandy Alexanders, talking about books and opera, American politics — they were Republicans, Vince supported Roosevelt — and the war in Europe. They thought America should keep out of it. To Harold, Marie was the greatest woman ever, and he thought his brother would be lucky to have her. Vince soon reconsidered. After another spat with Marie, he wrote a note of reconciliation and left it at her apartment. "Darling Ree," it began, "I love you so much, Ree. I'm sorry about last night. I'm with you 100%. Have been here since 10 this morning, alone since 11:30 a.m. It is now about 1. Intend to leave soon. I even brought up some buns this a.m. Thought maybe you and I could have some coffee and... Sorry to have missed you, honey. I love you with all my heart. I mean that. Sincerely, Vincent." A date was soon set for the wedding. He and Marie were married on Saturday, August 31st, 1940, at the Church of Our Lady of Refuge on East 196th Street in the Bronx. The nuptial mass was performed by the Reverend Jeremiah F. Nemechek, a Fordham football fan who idolized the 7 blocks of granite. Mary Planets watched as her husband walked down the aisle with their daughter Marie and took a seat next to his lover, Mary's sister, Cass. The other daughter, Marge Planets, the maid of honor, was so upset with her father and Cass that she refused to acknowledge their presence. Most of the Izzo clan came up from Sheepshead Bay, filling the church with goodwill. But Maddie Lombardi seemed less than overjoyed that day. After stepping in to restore the engagement, she could barely repress her earlier attitude that no one was good enough for her son. She and other family members privately worried that Vince was marrying Marie for the wrong reasons. She was blonde and buxom, a blue-eyed Irish German, the daughter of a stockbroker, a step up the social ladder. None of that underlying tension was evident in the wedding pictures. Marie looks luxuriant, in a white bridal gown, with a 7-foot train that drapes the floor in a semicircle around the smiling Vince, in black tails and striped tie, proudly displaying his wedding ring, which had inscriptions of the Sacred Heart and Blessed Virgin inside the band. The couple ventured to Maine for their honeymoon. Marie later confided that she was a virgin bride, and that her first night in the conjugal bed was a difficult experience for her, as was the entire adjustment to life with her new husband. He seemed preoccupied with football even on their honeymoon, and cut it short to get back to Englewood before the first Saints practice. "I wasn't married to him 1 week. she related later. When I said to myself, Marie Planets, you've made the greatest mistake of your life. His temper, his obsession with sports, his compulsion to tell other people what to do, the tension between his dominant public persona and his innate shyness and private anxiety, all were apparent to her from the start. But she had married Vince because he seemed solid, religious, and faithful, unlike her father. She believed, as he did, in the sacredness and lifelong commitment of marriage. She told herself that she would have to adjust. Bored and stuck in a little second-floor apartment on Grand Avenue in Englewood, she scrambled for ways to fill the ocean of hours when Vince was working with his boys. She drank coffee and pink ladies, and played cards with the mothers of St. Cecilia Players. She walked to Palisade Avenue with Palau's new wife, Margaret, a southern girl from North Carolina, who had just had a baby and lived in the same apartment building. On the way over, she taught Margaret how to talk northern. Penny, not pinny, for the coin. After they'd shopped for both families at the market, Margaret carried the infant on the return trip while Marie pushed the baby carriage stocked with food. The hard part was lifting the loaded carriage up the four front steps. Once every few weeks, Marie rode the bus back into New York to spend the day walking around Manhattan with Vince's brother Harold. She refined her artistic skills, crocheting and creating intricate Christmas ornaments. Late on weekend nights, when Vince was at last free from athletics, he took Marie out to his favorite haunts with the Palaus and other friends. They often drove up Route 9W to Englewood Cliffs for a late meal at Leo's, and then some band music at the Rustic Cabin, where they fell into the habit of buying a beer and steak sandwich for a performer who came over to their table to chat after his closing set, a skinny young Italian crooner from Hoboken named Frank Sinatra. In all of those ways, the evidence suggests that Marie adjusted admirably and tried to make the most of her marriage with Lombardi. She also learned quickly how to give it back to him and make him retreat after he'd yelled at her. But on a deeper level, she never adjusted. Haunted already by the trauma of her family history, by the unshakable reality that her father had run off with her aunt, she found only more heartache in her early efforts to create a family of her own. She became pregnant soon after her wedding, but at 7 months, the unborn infant died in her womb. With her doctor refusing to induce a birth, Marie carried the dead fetus inside her for several more weeks, a miserable period of prayer and mourning that she spent in bed at the Lombardi house in Brooklyn. In the aftermath of that tragedy, she began drinking heavily. Harold Lombardi, who tried to help, remembered that she was in a perpetually troubled state of mind. She seemed distressed, her sister-in-law Madeline said later. It had a terrible effect on her. At times, Vince was so preoccupied with teaching and coaching that he seemed unaware of his wife's troubles. He knew that she had a drinking problem, but considered it largely a matter of will and discipline. She was too weak, he told her. She either had to learn how to hold her liquor, as he did, or abstain from alcohol, an attitude that only led her to try to hide her drinking from him. Their relationship vacillated between hostility and adoration. They were a handsome and lively couple, their presence announced by their explosive laughter, but they snapped at each other over little things, unmindful that friends might hear them. They were chain smokers, their ashtrays overflowing with butts, and incessantly blamed each other for burn marks on their Danish modern furniture. Vince attended Mass at St. Cecilia's each morning and prayed for calm and control of his temper, of her drinking. Once, in the car with his sister Madeline, a desk clerk at the Waldorf Astoria, he cried in despair about his marriage. When Marie became pregnant again, Vince's mother insisted that she return to the Lombardi house for bed rest a month before the due date. The pregnancy was difficult, but resulted in the successful birth of a son on the morning of April 27, 1942, at Prospect Heights Hospital. He was named Vincent Henry Lombardi. Vince and Marie had agreed on the first name, but she was surprised by Henry, a middle name that Vince had provided to the nurses without consulting her. Where did that come from? Vince explained that Henry, or Enrico, was his father's real name. It was traditional in Italian families for the first son to be named after the grandfather. Marie had wanted her son to be a junior, Vincent Thomas Lombardi Jr. In any case, the arrival of the baby temporarily eased the tension in the marriage. The birth gifts included a carriage from Pop Lombardi, a crib from Gramps Planets, and a big leather football from the family doctor. Everyone said that baby Vincent was going to grow up to be a football player. Marie had a family now, more than she expected. When she and Vince and the baby drove back to Englewood on May 7th in their old blue Buick, they were joined by Harry and Matty, who had moved out of Sheepshead Bay with little Joe and found a house on Knickerbocker Road not far from Saints and their oldest son, the football coach. Football and religion were conjoined at Saints in every manner possible. The team played on Sundays, the only time Saints could gain access to Winton J. White Stadium, since Englewood Dwight Morrow High laid claim to the municipal field on Saturdays. Before every game, the preparation for battle resembled a holy rite. After the players put on their pads and uniforms, Coach Lombardi led them out from the dank basement locker room and directed them down the slope to church, their cleats clickety-clacking on the sidewalk and up the marble steps as they entered the sanctuary to attend Mass and receive communion. The few minutes that count before a game, noted the caption over a yearbook picture depicting the team on its knees, huddled in a semicircle of prayer near the front altar. At the end of pre-game Mass, a cluster of nuns greeted the squad out front on Demarest and distributed sacramentals. Little bleeding hearts made of red felt. Some boys stuffed the hearts inside their pants or helmets. Lombardi tucked his under the sock of his left cleat. A man of superstition, he also was careful to wear the same coat and hat to every game. The boys rode to the stadium standing in the open bed of an oil stock truck. On the way up Tenafly Road, they sang, on, Cecilia, fight on for your fame, to the tune of Wisconsin's familiar fight song. Before the opening kickoff, Lombardi gathered his charges at the sideline to recite the Lord's Prayer. The bleachers were a swarm with thousands of fans, in part because the Saints were a powerhouse team, but also because in that era, when television had not penetrated the American culture and professional football was considered a minor sport, the Saints were a main source of Sunday entertainment in North Jersey. Strangers traveled by bus from towns 30 miles away to watch them play. The grandstands nudged up to the team bench, and Harry Lombardi was always right there, lighting his good luck luckies, sitting as close to his son as he could, along with his brood, which included Marie and baby Vincent. In a tradition that defined his offbeat character, old 5x5 climbed the cyclone fence and sneaked into games without paying. The ushers let it pass with a shake of the head. There goes Lombardi's old man. On the ride home, the boys belted out the same raucous tune every week, My Wild Irish Rose. And if they won, which was most of the time, the truck pulled into the half-circle driveway at the Sisters of Charity convent. As nuns streamed onto the broad front porch and peered out second-floor windows, the squad serenaded them with the school song. Saint Cecilia, Saint Cecilia, we sing it in our way. We love our alma mater tried and true, and all we are and all we have, we give it all to you. The sisters had prayed for victory. How could Saints lose? The 1942 season was Lombardi's first as head football coach. Palau had left that summer to return to Fordham to coach the Rams' backfield. This was not the same program that Handy Andy and Butch had been part of back in the mid-1930s. Sleepy Jim Crowley had left for military service after Pearl Harbor, and many on his staff and squad had followed him. Within a year, the Fordham program would close down for the remainder of the war, never to regain its previous stature. Still, Palau's leaving frustrated Lombardi, even as it provided him with a new opportunity. He fretted that everyone was a rung ahead of him up the coaching ladder of success. First Nat Pierce, now Palau, had made it back to the college ranks at Fordham. Johnny Drews was an assistant at Notre Dame. Leo Paquin was coaching at Xavier Prep in Manhattan. But the fact that Palau left ahead of Vince was no surprise. He'd always been one of the Fordham administration's favorites, and his record at Saints did nothing to hurt his reputation. The team lost only one game in 1940 and went undefeated in 1941. It apparently didn't occur to Fordham's new coach, Earl Walsh, that the brains behind the Saints' operation was the old right guard, the forgotten block. Lombardi was bursting with ideas after Palau left, eager to assert himself as head man. He took his boys out to Hackettstown, New Jersey, for a 2-week training camp and installed a new offense, merging the Notre Dame box with a variation of the T formation. He'd learned the T himself the previous spring after attending a coaching clinic and picking up a pamphlet co-written by Clark Shaughnessy and George Halas. First Shaughnessy at Stanford in 1940, and then Halas with the professional Chicago Bears in 1941, had found great success with the T, which had been largely out of favor until they revised and restored it. In the T, the quarterback stands close behind the center to take the snap, with a fullback directly behind him and a halfback on either side of the fullback. The formation was as old as rugby, predating the American football game, but only with the innovations of Shaughnessy and Halas did it reveal its full offensive potential. There were two keys to their new T. Putting a man in motion to distract the defense, and using the quarterback as a true field general who would handle the ball on every snap and control the field of play through sophisticated fakes, handoffs, and passes. The T required precision and constant practice, but not great physical prowess, an offense that seemed made for Lombardi and his Saints, the first team in the area to use it. Offensive football became Lombardi's mistress. Late at night, when Marie and baby Vincent were asleep, he sat at his kitchen table, filling the ashtray with Chesterfield butts and studying plays. Sometimes he found a new variation that excited him so much that he couldn't even wait until practice the next afternoon to try it out. Instead, he took a few boys out of class for a half hour in the morning and brought them down to the gym to run through the play. Repetition was at the core of his coaching philosophy, doing the same thing over and over again, whether it was a play or a calisthenic, he believed, would make his boys fearless and instinctive. He said, "What I'm going to do, I'm going to drive you. I know the average level of conditioning at other schools. We're going to surpass that." Joe McPartland, a fullback on those Saints teams, remembered. That was the genius of Lombardi that you could see right away. He pushed you and pushed you and made you strong. The Saints campus didn't have a practice field. When school ended at 3 o'clock, the boys dressed in the locker room and walked a half mile to McKay Park, a hike that took them through the heart of Englewood's downtown. Wearing pads and cleats and sometimes loaded down with equipment that didn't fit into Lombardi's Buick, the Saints Brigade made such a racket that homeowners and shopkeepers heard the squad approaching from blocks away. People came out to their porches or storefronts to trade quips with the boys and cheer them along. As they passed a downtown fruit stand, a few players inevitably swiped apples. Father Tim Moore, who served as Lombardi's assistant, knew what they were doing. He often took confession from them in the parking lot after practice, and pleaded with them to stop, saying that the poor fruit vendor was going broke. Once, when a ravenous lineman persisted in filching apples, the good Irish father calmly took off his collar, barked, "Didn't I tell you?" and decked the wayward saint with a hard right. Corporal punishment was not an everyday thing at the school, but neither was it forbidden. Lombardi limited his hitting to the practice field. Nothing engaged him like the explosive moment of contact between blocker and tackler. He was his own blocking sled. One practice routine called for every boy to charge off the line and hit the head coach as hard as possible. "Hit me! Hit me!" he shouted, his voice echoing through McKay Park, deep and intimidating. The boys felt conflicted by this demand. When you would see him at practice, you would say to yourself, "Oh, my God, he's going to take me on today," recalled John Gassy de Gasperis, a Saints guard. You had equal parts courage and fear. You wanted to go hard, but you could never hurt him. And if you did, he never let on to you. Al Quilici, a roughneck little Saints halfback, said that one of the lasting memories of his life was the day he cracked Lombardi in the jaw with a vicious elbow and the coach smiled and thundered, "That's the way to do it!" Football, Lombardi preached to his boys, was a lesson in life. They were going to get knocked down, but they had to drag themselves up and take another hit and do it right. Rarely were there enough hours in the day for Lombardi and football. In the manner of Sleepy Jim, his old coach at Fordham, he kept his players on the field past sundown on autumn evenings, running plays over and over in the dusk. If it became too dark to see, but he was still unsatisfied, he herded the team near the parking lot and illuminated the area with headlights from his Buick and the cars of townspeople who'd come to watch practice. Soon enough, he discovered the limits to how far he could drive young players. At one twilight practice, as he ran the same play over and over, shouting at a lineman who persisted in making the same mistake, the player suddenly burst into tears of frustration. Here was a youngster who tried hard, but was less intelligent and athletic than many of the boys, and his response to criticism jolted Lombardi. He came to realize fully for the first time, he said later, that there were limitations to the game due to mentality and physical ability, and that the amount that can be consumed and executed is controlled by the weakest man on your team. There were ways to hide the physical liabilities of the weakest member of the team, Lombardi concluded, but every player has to do his own thinking. From then on, he tried to coach so that he was understandable to the slowest member of the squad. The situation that Lombardi inherited from Palau was in some ways unenviable, a record that would be hard to match, including 2 state Catholic championships and a 13-game winning streak and only 3 returning lettermen to lead the way. Furthermore, a fluke in scheduling found the Saints playing their fiercest opponent twice that season. They opened against rival Englewood Dwight Morrow and ended with them again on Thanksgiving Day. In his first game as a football head coach, Lombardi lost. Englewood beat his Saints 18-7, T-formation and all, ending the winning streak and worrying the coach and the team's fans. That night, the St. Cecilia Rooters were quiet, the school yearbook reported. There was no blast of horns, or snake dance down Palisade Avenue, or bonfires. We could hardly believe that Englewood had won, but with determined minds we vowed that in the return game the outcome would be reversed. That completed the losing for the year. There were 2 ties, but no more defeats in a season marked by 2 notable triumphs. First, a 32-6 thumping of powerful West New York Memorial, during which Lombardi's T-formation attack amassed 197 yards passing. And then a 7-0 shutout of Dwight Morrow, a season-ending victory that loosed the celebration that had been stifled by the earlier defeat. After serenading the nuns on Tenafly Road, hundreds of fans gathered at the school courtyard to cheer some more, then headed down the valley to Palisade Avenue, their hearts full of joy as they paraded along the downtown strip past Mac's Luncheonette and Pat's Toys, the Paramount Beauty Salon, and Jabocas Shoes, the Young Colony Shop and Pearlman's Liquor, Charlie Wilson's Bowling Hall and Buckley's Drugstore, singing On Cecilia all the way. From there, they worked their way up to the house Lombardi and his family had moved into that season. When the gleam-toothed visage of the new coach appeared at the door, horns blew and the students yelled at the top of their lungs. Vince and Marie invited the students in for refreshments, and there was old Pop Lombardi regaling the crowd. With their spirits still running high, the students drove back to the stadium and sprinted across the empty field, whooping it up. Later, the Englewood School Board sent Saints its annual bill for alleged damages to the goalposts and scoreboard. It was football glory for Lombardi and his Saints thereafter. The opening loss to Englewood turned out to be the last they would suffer in four seasons, until Seton Hall Prep beat them in the third game of 1945. It was a streak of 32 unbeaten games, including three ties, and inside that streak was another more spectacular one, 25 straight wins, beginning with the rout of Memorial and ending with a scoreless tie in a bowl game against Union Hill at the end of 1944. The undefeated 1943 team, state parochial school champions and perhaps the best of the decade, surrendered only three touchdowns all year and outscored opponents by the overwhelming total of 267 points to 19, despite being outweighed in every matchup. With a new four-linebacker defense Lombardi had installed, they won eight games by shutouts, one of them a 6-0 win in the Legion Bowl against Jersey City Lincoln in front of 12,500 fans. Little Saints challenged any school in the region during those years, the best of New York City and Hudson County, and beat them all, including a Brooklyn Prep team that featured a wily little back named Joe Paterno. Before the game against Prep, Lombardi gathered his squad in the locker room and read a series of nasty letters and telegrams that he said had been sent from Brooklyn. He didn't tell his enraged players that he'd concocted the defamatory material himself. That revelation came only years later in late-night reminiscences with his friend and colleague Paterno, who had gone on to star at Brown University and begin a luminous coaching career at Penn State, reaching a status in the college ranks nearly equivalent to Lombardi's later in the pros. Lombardi believed in fair play, he told his players, but not in the concept of good losing. He equated a loss with a sin. "I don't want any good losers around here," Joe McPartland remembered him telling the squad every year. "If you think it's good to be a loser, give the other guy the opportunity." Good losing, he said, was just a way to live with yourself. It's a way to live with defeat. He was so intense that he wouldn't even talk to the Englewood coach if he saw him in church. He was consumed with finding the edge that would assure victory. On Thursday nights, he invited the quarterbacks and captains over to the house for a working dinner, at which they studied plays for that Sunday's game. Between breaks and classes, he hauled a few more players into his office to talk football. When teams started to adjust to the T formation, he devised ways to switch it with the Notre Dame box at the last second, so the defense would be off guard. When he entered the locker room with a smile on his face, the boys usually knew what was up. "Wait till you hear this one." He had stayed up all night, diagramming a new play. Sometimes he said plays came to him in his dreams. In practice, the first 3 days of the week before a big game against Xavier, he built up the opponents to make them seem like monsters. "They're gonna kill you. They're gonna wipe you guys up." "It was like impending doom, disaster," said Iggy McPartland, one of his backs. "You didn't want to be disgraced in front of your family." But in the locker room before the game, after the referee stuck his head in to say it was time to take the field, Lombardi worked himself into a tear-inducing frenzy. Now his team could do no wrong. "You guys have worked so hard. They're a great team out there, but they'll never see the day they can touch you. You have more of what it takes than any 10 teams I've seen." His little saints in blue and gold charged onto the field, unbeatable. While confident that he could take any group of boys and mold them into a football team, Lombardi was not naive about what made the difference. He was on an endless search for talent. Union City, Bergenfield, Cliffside Park, Clifton. He and Father Moore traveled the roads of North Jersey from one parish to another, looking for players. John De Gasperis was in eighth grade in Cliffside Park when his teacher said there were two visitors who wanted to meet the class. All of a sudden, Father Tim and Coach Lombardi walk in. Father Tim talks first and says, "I'd like you to meet the football coach." When you saw Lombardi, you were just awed by him. He had a smile, a voice, a big husky build. You said, "Wow." I had no intention of going to a Catholic school, but he'd heard about me from another kid from my town who went there, and at the end of the session he called me over and said, "You're coming to Saints." I told him my family had no money. He said, "Don't worry, you're coming to Saints." The local parish agreed to help pay De Gasperis's way. To save money, he hitchhiked to Englewood and back, often getting home after 7 at night. But he became the best middle linebacker in North Jersey, proud to wear the big gold C. It wasn't just strapping specimens Lombardi sought. He also paid particular attention to scrappy youngsters from working-class families. He discovered Al Quilici from discussions with the local police, who told him about a kid who could outrun the law and was always fighting. Quilici had moved out to Englewood with his family from a cold water flat in New York City. He helped bring in money for his parents, running up Englewood's hill at 4 in the morning to feed horses at stables owned by the town's equestrian elite. Lombardi promised him a scholarship and chance to wear the Saints uniform, and asked only that he confine his aggression to the football field. "You follow my way, and I'll get you a scholarship to college," the coach told him. When Quilici arrived at Saints, Lombardi arranged for him to get into a typing class. It would help make his small hands more dexterous, the coach said, and also result in neater papers and better grades. It all proved true. Quilici starred at Saints, learned to type 85 words a minute on a manual typewriter, and was recruited to play big-time college football at Arizona. The truth about Lombardi was that his outward bluster barely concealed his soft spot for players, even in the classroom. When he encountered someone like Joe McPartland, a better student than athlete, he called on him daily in physics and pushed him to use his intelligence on the field. "Think, Joe. Use your head." But when De Gasperis approached him after the first week of physics and confessed that he couldn't handle the material, Lombardi immediately transferred him to general science. "Otherwise, he would have had to fail me," De Gasperis said later. He turned out to be a friend. Iggy McPartland, Joe's less academic little brother, said Lombardi essentially gave him and many other football players a free pass in class during the season. He did favor the football players. He didn't call on me until after Thanksgiving. He figured the football players were engaged in a sport that took a lot of time and that we were enhancing the image of the school, so he was considerate. The other students could be studying at home while we were still down at McCabe Park, practicing under the headlights. After the season, he'd look at me in class like he'd never seen me before and go, "Hey, you!" And I'd stand up and mumble something. I'd figure I was wrong. I didn't understand physics, and he'd say, "Very good, sit down." The Sisters of Charity had such melodious names. Sister Symphrosa for history, Sister Theophany for mathematics, Sister Mary Aquinas for Spanish, Sister Rose Magdalene for English, Sister Anna Madeline for Latin, Sister Louise Marie for French. But the most memorable sister at Saints was known for more than her lyricism. She was Sister Louise Baptista, the principal. The students called her the Bap. a big-boned, intelligent woman with a sharp Boston accent. The Bap was fearless and fearsome, walking the halls of saints in her black habit, her face framed in tight white cloth, a one-nun security patrol. Talk too much in class or act up in the hallway, and the Bap would order you to kneel in humble contrition before she thwacked you with her punishment stick. Joe McPartland got walloped a few times by the Bap. She had a good-sized arm, he said. There was no zone of privacy for students as far as the Bap was concerned. She inspected girls' pocketbooks looking for cigarettes, and if she suspected something awry in the boys' bathroom, she harumphed, "Gentlemen, I'm coming in," and barged through the swinging door. The Bap understood her hormone-driven adolescent charges and seemed almost to mock them in her bluntness. "I found a pair of bloomers, and they're not mine," she reported one day over the school loudspeaker. Then she paused 10 seconds, anticipating the giggles her announcement would elicit before scolding, "You filthy children!" The students at Saints made fun of her behind her back, imitating her tank-like build and unfamiliar accent. But what they never realized is that she was on to them as well. One of the favorite sisterly, if somewhat uncharitable, games at the convent was a variation of charades in which the Bap acted out the roles of students and others guessed who they were. Not everyone subscribed to Sister Bap's authoritarian ways. Some officials in Englewood had begun to worry about the incipient problem of juvenile delinquency and express fears at public debates that harshness and cruelly severe punishments for minor infractions would only alienate the children further. What they shared with the nun and other disciplinarians was an inherent belief that it was the responsibility of teachers, parents, and civic leaders to instill in the youth of Englewood a set-value system through every means possible. The established code of ethics of the community, while often ignored in the private lives of town fathers, was articulated in a series of full-page advertisements printed in the Englewood Press. One Thanksgiving Day ad, under the blaring headline, "Small sins make liars, liars make criminals, first of all, truth," sermonized that the compulsion to lie was at the root of most delinquency. To tell the truth always is the principle that will take your son and daughter further than any other. In the school, on the playground, in the home, the boy or girl who abhors a lie is not likely to commit those sins which demand lying to avoid exposure. At Saints, ethical values were largely passed on not by the priests and nuns, but by Vince Lombardi, who found his pulpit everywhere, on the playing field, in the classroom, and at school-wide auditorium meetings. He was the one person to whom Sister Bap acceded. Dorothy Bachman, salutatorium at Saints in 1944, thought all the nuns loved him. They were not afraid of Vince, but they respected him for the way he presented his values to the students. Saints football, with its discipline, subservience, and teamwork, was considered the ideal demonstration of proper teenage behavior, and Lombardi the purveyor nonpareil of the football philosophy. He was one of only 4 men on the Saints faculty of 19 teachers. It was perhaps a typical ratio at a high school run by nuns, especially during the war years. That Lombardi was at Saints at all, rather than in the military, was unusual. Though he was colorblind and nearsighted, other men with those liabilities were drafted into the service during World War II. Marie had expressed early reservations about the war and had attended an America First rally at Madison Square Garden in 1941, but Vince was adamant in his hatred of Hitler and in full support of the war effort. The Izzos were a patriotic lot. More than a dozen of his cousins and uncles had enlisted, including Tony Izzo, who was staying with Henry and Mattie in Englewood while attending Fordham when he joined the Navy. Vince said that he tried to enlist, but flunked a physical because of his poor eyes. That is possible. At least one of his friends, Francis Garrity, the basketball coach at Dwight Morrow, later said that he was with Lombardi when it happened. But there's no government record of any such event. Lombardi's Selective Service System records indicate that Bergen County Draft Board No. 7 gave him deferments throughout the war. The first deferment, in December 1941, was a 2A in the national interest for teaching. In 1943, he received a 3A deferment for dependency reasons. He was the sole provider then for Marie and baby Vincent. But other young fathers were not deferred during the war. By April 1944, he had been reclassified 4A, deferred by reason of age. He was then almost 31 years old. The fact that he did not serve was not held against Lombardi and his community. The prevailing attitude was that the students at Saints were lucky to have a strong male figure available to mold them during those difficult years. Here was a paradox in Lombardi's character. He was never a soldier. He was never a priest. Yet he seemed the embodiment of the soldier-priest in the line of Ignatius of Loyola. The students at Saints regarded him with fear and respect. Their newspaper, The Arcade, applied popular song titles to personalities at Saints and matched Mr. Lombardi with Mean to Me. He was known to throw an eraser at a daydreaming student, and his students came to learn the warning signs of a Lombardi eruption. He would just stand there mute, and his eyes would start blinking harder and harder. That was the sign that an explosion was coming, recalled Don Crane, one of his students. When his eyes started to blink, you stayed away. Only one student was truly in danger of suffering harm at Lombardi's hands. His youngest brother, Joe, who'd enrolled at Saints as a freshman in 1943. Joe looked like his older brother and even played the same position in football, guard. But his disposition was the opposite, sweet and easy. Being coached by his big brother was bad enough. "Lombardi, you're living on my name. You stink!" Vince screamed at him in practice. But it was in the classroom where Joe suffered most. In his sophomore year, he coasted through school, thinking that as a football star, he didn't have to study. At an awards program at the end of the year, his brother disabused him of that notion. Vince was the master of ceremonies that day in the auditorium, calling students to the stage to receive scholastic honors and their report cards. As the program ended, Lombardi said that he had one special mention, and brought up his brother. One by one, he read off Joe's poor grades. As Joe stood there sheepishly, Vince grew madder and redder, his eyes blinking violently, until finally he uncorked a wild swing at his little brother, who ducked and raced frantically for the exit, where one of his football teammates, Hooks Cerruti, had propitiously stationed himself, letting Joe through and then closing the door before Vince, huffing in pursuit, could catch him. The program ended right there in chaos, with students scrambling out of the way of the raging bull, Mr. Lombardi. Vince caught him later that night at home. The students were fearful about what would happen the following Monday, but Lombardi acted as though nothing had happened. For the most part, his intimidation was more a matter of demeanor than action. Dorothy Backman recalled that her lab partner in chemistry was so afraid of Lombardi that she never uttered a word all year. "She would never open her mouth, and I had to do all the experiments because she was too scared." Lombardi tried to lighten things up with humor, but his jokes were always stale groaners that he laughed at harder than any of the kids. He was a believer in pop quizzes and would stroll down the aisle singing, "I'm forever blowing bubbles," occasionally stopping to peruse someone's answer sheet. By all accounts, even though he scared some students, Lombardi was an effective teacher, able to explain physics and chemistry in comprehensible terms. He often spent a week repeating one concept until the slowest student in the class understood. He made the subject clear and succeeded in communicating all the essentials so that all the students could get good grades, said Joe McPartland. He had a great way of sensing whether you were getting it. He'd say, "I don't think you really understood that," and go over it again. When not in the classroom, Lombardi spent most of the day in his office, which he shared with Father Tim Moore. Father Tim was a bright and light-hearted priest, more interested in forgiveness and redemption than the wrath of God. Although he did smack a football player for stealing one too many apples, his customary role as assistant football coach was to take players aside and reassure them after Lombardi had chewed them out. If he entered a classroom and noticed that a nun had marked down names for detention, he might back up to the blackboard and surreptitiously erase them. Since he heard confession at the church next door, he knew the secret lives of nearly everyone in the school, and handled their sins with equanimity. He would open the sliding window, and you would confess your sins to Father Tim without fear, recalled Don Crane, who played on the basketball team. We used to steal our sweatpants and jackets and confess to him. He'd tell us to bring them back. We'd bring them back on Monday and steal them again on Friday. For Lombardi, who attended Mass daily and went to confession several times a week, Father Tim's proximity was particularly handy. We'd be sitting there talking about something, and all of a sudden, Vinny would say, "Tim, I want to go to confession," the priest remembered later. So I'd take his confession right there from my desk, and when he was done, we'd start right back into the conversation we had going before. Father Tim used to say that when he was too busy to hear confession, he just sent Lombardi over to church to substitute for him. People would laugh, but they weren't sure that he was joking. Often it was hard to tell which of the two was the priest, especially during off-hours. Father Tim grew close to Lombardi's parents and was a regular at their house on Knickerbocker Avenue. He stopped by on Saturday afternoons with a few of his brothers of the cloth, dressed in Hawaiian shirts. Vince often came over too, much to Marie's dismay, but usually napped in a big chair as Pops and the priests entertained each other long into the evening, knocking down scotches, devouring an enormous pot of Matty's famous clam chowder, and regaling one another with stories as they bickered over hands of gin rummy. The headline in the Bergen Evening Record ran across the top of the sports page on Tuesday, May 15th, 1945. Lombardi to lead Hackensack gridmen in fall. Underneath was a Dürer picture of the new Comet grid tutor and a story that began, "Vincent Thomas Lombardi is Hackensack High School's new football coach. The black-haired, bespectacled, but he hates wearing 'em and takes 'em off for pictures, 31-year-old coach comes to the county seat with a glittering record. For his Englewood St. Cecilia coach teams lost only one game in 3 years, tying 3 and winning 27 games." The move to the big public high school, the story went on, had been kept under many Stetsons the last few days, as the Hackensack School Board waited for Lombardi to get his release from St. Cecilia, where he still had 2 years to go on a 4-year contract. Lombardi said he regretted leaving Saints, but felt compelled to make the move because Hackensack provided tenure and more earning potential. "I feel it's a move I must make when I consider my family," he told the Record. The story was true in every respect, and ultimately wrong. Hours after he'd informed Hackensack officials and the Record reporter that he had been released by Saints, he changed his mind again, or had it changed for him. Father Tim refused to accept his decision. He said Vince was making a grievous mistake. By going to Hackensack, he was resigning himself to a career in the high school ranks, the priest argued. You have more ability than that. Marie also was opposed. The years at Saints had been traumatic enough for her. After the birth of Vincent, she had endured another tragedy. Her next pregnancy ended with the birth of a baby girl who died within 2 days of her birth. The fact that she saw this infant girl alive and had to bury her made it even more traumatic than the earlier stillbirth. An ill-informed doctor told her that she would never be able to have another successful birth, would never be able to have a baby girl. She had turned to alcohol again, and found that among the few things that made her happy were her husband's successes. The better his teams performed, the more recognition he gained, the better she felt about herself and her lot in life. One image stuck with her. Sitting in the stands the day Vin's long winning streak ended, looking down at him on the sidelines where he stood in the middle of a puddle, looking smaller and smaller as the game wore on and the rain fell harder. Friends had suggested that she leave, but she insisted on staying. If he could take it, she could take it. There was some larger purpose. She worried that he might be satisfied as a high school football coach. Furthermore, she was growing tired of sharing him with his family, especially Harry and Mattie, who seemed more connected to the local high school culture than she was. Father Tim was right, she said. Hackensack is a dead end. Stay at Saints until something bigger than high school comes along. That night, little Joe and John DeGasperis and Al Quilici led a band of boys from the football team over to Vince's house on Mountain View Road and begged for Coach Lombardi to come out and talk with them. Gassie and Joe, known as the Gold Dust Twins, left guard and right guard, best friends and captains, had tears in their eyes when they asked Lombardi to stay with them through their senior year. He was brought to tears himself and relented, revealing a paradoxical pattern that persisted down through the years. Here was a man who seemed to the outside world to be in complete control, certain of what he was doing and where he was going. Internally, it was never that way. Vince Lombardi was often conflicted, constantly changing his mind. Father Tim called Hackensack and said there had been a misunderstanding. Vince had not been let out of his contract at Saints. He would fulfill his obligation and stay 2 more years. Chapter 5. Lost in the Bronx. The American life, abundant, was there for all to enjoy in the shade of the grape arbor behind the old Izzo homestead in Sheepshead Bay on the last Sunday of August 1947. Dozens of hot dogs and garlic-rubbed hamburgers from Lombardi Brothers sizzling on the grill, buns toasting, mounds of black olives, hot red peppers, sliced Bermuda onions, and cold cuts heaped on picnic tables, barrels of draft beer flowing free and easy. All 13 adult children of the late Antonio and Laura Izzo making the pilgrimage along with their spouses. J.C. Sapp, husband of Mattie's little sister Amelia, greeting everyone in barbecue apron and tall white chef's hat. Harry Lombardi, recovering rambunctiously from a heart attack he'd suffered earlier in the year, arriving gaily in spat-like two-tone shoes with white laces and dress shirt rolled up to reveal his tattoos, a pack of smokes in his breast pocket. The swelling throng of 33 grandchildren, Vince and his cousins, and their families, including husbands, wives, and 21 great-grandchildren. In all, the backyard on East 16th Street pulsating with 96 Izzo relatives, 6 namesakes of the patriarch Tony the Barber among them, along with 4 Claras, 4 Richards, 2 Vincents, and 2 Humberts. Not a long-lost stranger in the crowd. Only 2 living beyond the boundaries of Brooklyn, 1 family out in Floral Park on the edge of Nassau County, and the Lombardis across the Hudson in Englewood. Festively colored paper streamers were draped high from tree to tree. Dangling from the boughs were exotic Japanese lanterns brought home by some of the 15 Izzo veterans who had been stationed in the Pacific during the war. As rumba tunes vibrated from the radio, young adults danced on a sheet of linoleum laid out on the grass, and children